You're listening to Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and hot takes about all 12 NPB teams. Hosted by Jim Allen and John E. Gibson.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the weekend of Christmas. Merry Christmas. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a random Thursday night in December is my partner, Jim Allen. How are you doing, man?
Ho, ho, ho. I'm good.
Ho, ho, ho. He says that he didn't even remember it was Christmas time. I'll tell you that.
I beg to differ. I did know it was Christmas. Not like I was prepared or anything after, close to 40 years in Japan. I'm so de-Christmasized.
Yes.
That actually, Terry and I are actually planning to have a Christmas tree next year. That'll be my first in Japan.
Oh my goodness.
In my 39th, it'll be my 39th Christmas in Japan and my first with a Christmas tree.
Wow, you got that, people? So yeah, he knew it was Christmas because next year he's going to have a tree.
I did, because I got a Christmas card I haven't written yet on the table. I'm thinking, let's see, mail it or not?
Well, just to let you guys know, I sent a message to Jim the other day and I said, hey, you want to do a show? And he said, why
kinda
not?
Kind of like hoping he would say, no, I'm good.
No, you know what? We're planning. We're trying to get together another panel discussion. And if we do that, we're not going to have time to get to all these things. And I thought, you know, we haven't done a Christmas show ever, probably, or not in a long time for sure.
Oh.
We're heading into our 13th season. Let's wrap all this stuff up. And then when we head into the new year, we can do a panel discussion and start everything all fresh. So, on this week's show, we've got a lot of news to cover. We offer our takes on the new big leaguers. We look back at the past season's awards and a whole lot more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right. So first of all, we are going to have our 500th show sometime next year. I will count them up and figure out when that is exactly. But that means, you know what that means, Jim? That means
I don't know. What does it mean, John?
It means that you and I have been talking baseball together for at least 500 hours the past 13 years.
That's kind of a minimalist.
Well, at least, because that's what the show is about, runs about an hour.
Right.
But,
oh,
yeah,
I see.
To be honest,
you've released 500 hours of talk.
At least, yes.
I think we're about double that, to be honest.
Double that, yes. Given the pre-recording and post-recording chats
and the rants, yeah, and the this and that and the other and the good times, lots of good times.
So I'll try to add that up and figure out exactly which show it is, so we can do something special.
All right.
It's gonna happen in year 13 here. So let's start off our show here and talk about, what do we want to talk about first? I guess let's talk about the newest major league players. So
sure.
Masataka Yoshida of the Oryx Buffaloes, or previously of the Oryx Buffaloes, goes to the Boston Red Sox. And that was not a surprise to me in terms of the team, but it was quite a surprise in terms of the money.
Sure.
And before we get to that, noteworthy names whom NPB followers know and have watched in Boston over the years include Daisuke Matsuzaka, Koji Uehara, Hideki Okajima, and maybe most famously in recent years, Junichi Tazawa, because of that Tazawa rule. But we also did see stints with Boston by Hideo Nomo, and Takashi Saito spent a little bit of time there. So now this $90 million contract plus the posting fee and all this stuff that Boston forked up for a player, I'm just not sure is worth it. I got to be honest. I like Yoshida. I think he is a good, I think he could become the second coming of a kind of Mike Greenwell type, who played for Boston a long time ago in the 80s, used to bang balls off of the Green Monster as a left-handed batter, and got a lot of doubles. And that's something definitely that Yoshida could do, but I'm not sure $90 million is the price. But anyway, what did you think of that move?
Yeah, that was interesting because there were a number of stories put out of like, huh, what? Hey, kind of stories. And I was one because I was asked by Slugger Magazine to do a story about Yoshida, and the scouts I talked to, you know, it's like, we all kind of said, you know, some team, there's going to be some team that's going to be the Tampa Bay Yoshitomo Tsutsugo combination that's really going to like him. Mm-hmm. And they might pay $10 million a year for him. Ha! Okay. You know, that was sort of the scout's consensus. I can see that $8 to $10 million, you know, like he's not going to get Suzuki money. Oh man. Boston, you know, I missed it, but obviously it makes sense because it makes sense in 81 games a year because you're playing in Fenway Park with that little shallow, you know, that little tiny left field. It's right. Perfect. It's the left field for him. But then you go to other parks, which are normal or, mm-hmm. you know, which are different. And okay, so now, you know, there's that. But I would say I talked to eight or nine scouts, and basically everybody likes things, you know, they like things about him. But the biggest question, and I did have one scout say, I think he'll adjust to the major league fastballs because of his short, compact swing.
Okay. All right.
But pretty much everybody's going to go, that's a big question. My question, of course, was, is he going to do it at 30? And my best comparison, I missed this the last time we talked, mm-hmm. was Norichika Aoki. He's basically Norichika Aoki with more power and no speed. Okay. And they're going at almost the same age. And I think, bingo. And I had another scout, the scout who actually liked him, and Aoki, who did very well his first year with the Milwaukee Brewers, said, you know, that's what I take on him. The problem is he doesn't have a lot of leeway. And most of the scouts I talked to said he's going to need some runway in case things don't go well. Right off the bat, he'll need time to figure things out. They think he will figure things out. But the question was, is a team that thinks it's going to compete for a pennant going to give a lot of money to a guy and then let him figure it out when they're losing games and he's not producing? So I was surprised because of what people told me. And I was surprised because of what I thought based on that and my own convictions. But I can see how it will work, but I can also see how many different ways it could fail.
My comp essentially of him going to Boston was sort of a Akinori Iwamura kind of comp because that's another one I heard, a remake of his approach to the game and maybe change a few things because he's not going to be the same kind of power hitter he was. But, you know, my concerns were basically about his health and his defense. What are they going to do about those things? I do think he'll be able to hit. I just don't think it's going to be the power that we saw here in Japan. But, you know, again, if he can bang some balls off the monster and go the other way with some pitches, which we know he has good bat control and that's going to bode well for him. And I think he can do that. So I'm not really worried about the average so much. I just think it's the home runs are going to shrink.
Oh, yeah. And then Boston's also a great park for left-handed hitters. I mean, it probably helps left-handed hitters more than it helps right-handed hitters. So
right.
He's got that and the other thing.
So I think from your tweet, I think a tweet that you sent out, I got the idea you were thinking, that's why I kept saying, say it. And that was the word overpay, because I got the idea that you were thinking that.
Well, that was my impression. I thought they paid, they were the ones who wanted him. But I have to ask you.
Uh-oh. Don't turn the tables on me. Turn that back.
Sorry. I'm DJ Jazzy Jim. Right now, I got my table turned back fully. And I got to ask you, because first of all, there were questions about whether he would be posted, because Oryx said, we found out afterwards that their condition had nothing to do with Yoshida, but had to do with their signing one of the two big free agents in Japan. And they signed, and it's almost like the Boston Red Sox, Tomoya Mori, and the Oryx Buffaloes were all on the same page. Because
they were in lockstep. Yeah.
Yeah, because you basically never see a free agent signed within 3 or 4 days of announcing his free agency.
Mm-hmm.
And you never see a posted player sign on the same day he's posted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and, okay. And here's the other thing. Teams I talked to said they thought Yoshida was being posted. In the springtime, and why? I asked later why. Oh, because agents were telling us. An agent was telling us about him.
All right. So what's your question for me?
So my question is: didn't you think that was all quite weird that all these things happened? So bang, bang, bang.
No, I mean, I think a lot of these guys, as you say, if you're talking to agents and agents are working to get interest up in a client, then I think, yeah, they know within the industry. They shut us out, but they know within the industry. So I don't think that's a big surprise. And I think all those things kind of work together. That makes sense. What I was going to point out was that when we had our show with Jason on, I was the only one who said that I thought Yoshida had a chance to go. And I was confident in that he would be given the opportunity. So I thought you were going to ask me about that. Like, how did I know? And I'm like, I don't know anything. None of us really knows anything. We're just really good at.
Hold on a second. You make it sound like I do know stuff. Now, let's not go there because ain't right.
No, but
I got an image to maintain.
Right. I'm sure you do.
I mean, I rewrote that story for Slugger magazine saying nobody's going to want him.
Hashtag high heat.
But $90 million.
Yeah. Yeah. But my check's in the bank, so I'm good.
Good for you. Well, you know, I do see this again with Yoshi. I think it's a good fit for him. It's a right place, right time, right situation. And that team has finished, I listening to some other podcasts that they finished in the bottom, at the bottom of that division more times recently than the Yankees have, you know, since I was a kid or something to that effect. So I think this is a good fit for him in that he's going to get opportunity because they were bad before and they're not spending as much money as the Mets, whom we'll get to shortly, but you know, they're losing players and they'll give him an opportunity. So, and like you said, they're spending money and he's not producing. Yeah. There'll probably be a lot of pressure, but they've had pressure situations in the past. I think they'll give him ample time to make the adjustment. So he's a good guy for that role though. But I don't see $90 million in that bat, defense, running, and the other things. So he's really has to make up for that somehow.
But on the other hand,
remember,
of course,
it's $90 million plus because they also paid the posting fee.
Yeah, and then of course I guarantee you that the cheapest team in MLB could throw that money around like it was nothing.
If that team wanted to, that's true.
If they wanted to, if they thought, you know, we should win baseball games instead of sitting on our butts. then they could do it, but that's just not how MLB is this year is now, with the exception of probably 6 or 7 teams.
Well, I'm glad you agree that there are overpays, because I remember we had a discussion years and years ago about there not being overpays because the market sets the price.
Well,
what I said at the time was it matters who shows up in the room. And what they need.
Right. The market. Well, what I'm saying is the market is what the market is.
Sure.
And if somebody pays him, that's how much somebody thinks he's worth. And that's his market value. It's not his playing value, but it's his market value. So, I mean, you can't say, it's hard to say he's being overpaid at this stage. He's overpaid by our pre-estimates, I suppose.
Sure.
But he is, you know, he is valued at that. Obviously, the Boston Red Sox valued him at that price. I mean, when Hisashi Iwakuma failed to negotiate a posting deal with the Oakland A's, it was all about a massive disagreement between what Iwakuma and Don Nomura, his agent, thought Iwakuma was worth and what the A's decided they were willing to pay for him. So,
right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move along to Kodai Senga. He goes from SoftBank to the high spending, big spending.
Higher and bigger with each passing day.
New York Mets, who made what I, in my headline, I said, since the paper is going to come out tomorrow and this doesn't come out until probably Saturday, Sunday, I said he made a giant shift and jumped from the San Francisco side of the United States to the New York side. So all the way across the country, Carlos Correa jumped, but he'll be playing alongside Senga, with Senga on the mound. And I guess they're collecting a bunch of shortstops in New York too as well. But anyway, I didn't get this one either. And $75 million reported for Senga, that deal. I thought another overpay in that this is a pitcher with an injury history. And what is the pitching plan for him? We don't know that. He goes from 143 game season to 162 game season. What does that do? Are we talking about a once a week start? Are we talking about put him in the bullpen? I hear rotation. So I'm not thinking he's going to see bullpen time, but can he pitch, let's say, 23, 24 games? Because he really hasn't been doing that in MPB in recent years. I think his stuff is going to play well in the bigs, and I think he can get the batters out. I am strictly worried about a full season. His highest inning total was in 2019, and that was 180.1 innings. So really, this is $75 million. It's another one that I found a little bit perplexing and a kind of an overpay here. But then the Mets seem to be collecting guys who really don't play a full season or are on the verge of, you know, with Justin Verlander, he'll be 40. Correa is a guy who since 2015 has only hit the 150 game mark one time. And then you got Senga and some other guys. So they're throwing a lot of money at guys who could blow up and not be around, or can be sitting next to you and me watching the games. But anyway, what did you think about the Senga move?
Yeah, definitely the Mets. Mets all over that one. There was interest. There was a lot of interest in, I would say there was probably serious interest in Senga from a dozen teams.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good deal for him. I like Senga. I like that he, his agent. It's so funny because I was talking with one scout and, I was talking with an agent, a former agent, actually he's a current agent now. And a former scout is an agent. And we talked about how players tend to find scouts, find agents that are like them. And Senga is Joel Wolf is probably the agent who I respect the most. From talking with him at the winter meetings, he's a guy who basically never says anything that's not well prepared and well planned out and not in a Scott Boras kind of, let's see how smart I can be, but what's in the best interest, what's, you know, how close can I cut it to the truth kind of thing. You know, he tries to be straight within the boundaries of his work responsibility. And Senga's a really, really normal guy. I mean, I'm a huge fan of him individually. I think he's going to do really well. The main concern with Senga is his arm. It's not like he's had debilitating injuries, but he's had this nickel and dime store variety.
Mm-hmm.
They still have nickel. I guess they don't have nickel and dime store, 5 and 10 stores anymore. I'm dating myself.
They do. I think they do. They're still out there.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, he's basically been brought low by this regular season salad of elbow tightness, shoulder stiffness,
what
lower
kind of dressing
back.
Do you put on this salad?
Yeah.
Ace bandages.
indeed. Some kind of a compress, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Just I mean, yeah, I, I don't know about this.
As far as his stuff goes, you know, everybody's in love with the split, and his fastball is not my favorite fastball. In Japan, it's not one of my favorite fastballs in Japan because it tends to be straight and it tends to be, as often as not, nowhere near where he's trying to throw it.
It might help him out in the majors because they'll swing this swing.
Yeah, yeah, he's probably going to get a lot of unintended swings and misses on pitches he was trying to throw on the corner and ended up a foot away. So,
right.
but, you know, people have to respect the speed a lot in Japan, and they'll have to respect the speed in America as well. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see how that plays out. The forkball is particularly nasty, and he's got the stuff to figure it out. He's a creative guy. He's a fighter, and he's just a really, really nice guy. And so, hey, I wish him well.
Nice guys don't help you on the mound, but I like him. I'm rooting for him. I'm just worried about the health part. So,
yeah.
All right, let's look domestically. We have a couple guys we want to hit. I guess the biggest one is Tomoya Mori from Seibu to Oryx. Mm. And I thought, this kind of helps Oryx at the catcher position, but because Mori can DH, it opens up their ability to be flexible in having a DH, an actual consistent DH, if they want him to do that. But I think it makes their lineup a little bit more flexible. And he's so productive. And, you know, actually, I would say get him from behind the plate, rest those legs. He is going to start to age a little bit here as a catcher, you would assume. So I thought that was a big part of what he can get out of this move. But I do find it very odd, again, to mention this again, that we've seen this exodus of free agents and star free agents from Seibu. It's kind of alarming, and it's unnatural. You would think that they'd keep one or two of these guys, and they all seem to be leaving over the past 10 or so years.
Yep. They pretty much got publicly they expressed that, you know, they wanted to keep Mori as much as, and they said the same thing about Asamura, but I remember, of course, Takayuki Kishi is sort of the poster boy for Seibu Lions free agency. You want that much from somebody else, and you want us to have more interest than we do already? We already love you. We're not going to show you we love you more. So basically, take that check from somebody and get the hell off of our ball. Get the hell out of our ballpark. You know,
it's called conditional love. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's a condition.
Yeah, it's been weird. It's like Seibu's got that whole thing about, like, I don't know. I have to wonder how much of it has to come from the fact that nobody likes playing in that ballpark.
Huh.
And if you're going to play there,
I don't like watching games there, but I didn't know that they didn't like playing there.
Because it's the same. It's cold, and it's either freezing or it's boiling, and there's very little in between.
You know, simmer down.
Exactly. Well, it's a simmer. It's got simmer and freeze. It's got two settings.
You said boiling. I'll go
boil in your own sweat or freeze okay. Your body parts off.
I knew where you were going. Well, you're in mid-season form here, Jimmy Allen. Mid-season form. All right. Let's talk about Kensuke Kondo leaving the Fighters to go to SoftBank. And
yeah,
I thought
that's interesting. Yeah,
from my vantage point here in the offseason, it probably damages the offensively challenged Fighters to lose a player like Kondo. And I do think it boosts the Hawks, who recently dumped their contingent of foreign players as well. So they're going to have to retool in terms of the lineup and getting DHs together and all that stuff. But in the meantime, Kondo is a guy who's really going to help them. But he has missed chunks of seasons because of myriad injuries. And I just, in nine seasons, and again, we sound like two old get off my lawn men, but I mean, he doesn't play a full season a lot of times. He just goes missing with these injuries. You said, what did you say earlier? Not salad kind kind of type injuries, but or garden variety
garden salad
type injuries. Yeah. I don't know what they are, but he gets some injuries that you don't see, and then all of a sudden, and a lot of guys, you know, you see them, they're limping on the field, they come out of the game, and they're gone for a while. And with Kondo, it's like he plays, and then all of a sudden he doesn't play, and then all of a sudden he's deactivated, and all of a sudden they say a couple of days later or sometime later he's going to need surgery, he's gone for the season, or he's gone for a half a season, or he has played in 120 games only four times in his nine seasons, and the high was 138. So for whatever the reason is, he just never plays the full complement of games. I don't know what the deal is, but I wish him the best. But as he gets older, I don't see this situation getting better unless he plays fewer games and they don't have to use him as much.
Well, that's the thing, is also with the Hawks, you know, they've got, because the way Japanese baseball is constructed, where there's no options, minor league players can come up and down as often as they want them.
Elevator buys.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's no, you know, three options and you're a free agent kind of, you know, there's no stop on that elevator. There's no emergency stop red button that you can say, hey, I'm going to push it and get off and, you know, I'm out of here.
Right.
But so they can take, the Hawks have a large complement of guys who are plus defenders and adequate offensive players that they can rest. You know, they can lose Yuki and Nagita for a couple of weeks, and it's sort of like they really don't skip too much of a beat. And I think that's fine for them. My concern, well, of course, there wasn't a lot of there wasn't really any free agent pitching talent out there, which is really what the Hawks need. The Hawks were a badly balanced team last year.
Mm-hmm.
Their pitching was acceptable because of Kodai Senga.
Okay.
And that's a huge hole that they have not filled. Joe Gunkel may fill a bit of that, but, you know.
Yeah, moving over from Hanshin, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is they had a tremendous offense. They may have had the best offense in Japan last year, and they're going to have as good an offense. I think they'll have as good an offense next year, and their pitching is going to be worse. So they're going to be in that 2018-2019 Cebu Lions area, I think. They're going to be trying to win the pennant with the, you know, the worst ERA in Japan.
Oh, don't get John started with the four ERA.
No. I'm not going there. But I'm saying that was such a rare thing. But you know, it can happen. But as you said, it's not the ideal way for things. You know, I think that's more or less what you're trying to say. It's not the textbook way you build a team. Let's have a really lousy pitching and defense, although it was the pitching that was the problem. The Hawks do have a good defense, so that is going to help every pitcher who comes in there. But the pitchers needed more help than God could have given them last year.
Okay. All right, let's make a two-seam transition and look back at the MVPs. Now, this they had, as they've been doing, I guess, the past five or so years, they have one night of celebrations and honors, and everybody dresses up, mostly black tie, and I have never gone, and I don't think I will, but they announced the MVPs and the rookies, and I don't think there was any shock with the selections this season. Yoshinobu Yamamoto of the Oryx Buffaloes, their ace, was the Pacific League MVP. Munetaka Murakami of the Yakult Swallows was the Central League MVP. Do you think Yoshinobu was kind of a stretch? My MVP was Hotaka Yamakawa of the Cebu Lions. I just think he did more for his team. He played in so many games. He was only injured one long stretch.
Wasn't even a long stretch. I mean, it was the year before time, when he missed the whole couple of months. So
he wasn't out for too long. He hit 40 home runs, and I guess he only had 17 doubles, so that was a ding on his resume. And he hit fewer than 100 RBIs, so he really didn't produce enough with the power that he exhibited during the season, but And his team didn't win the pennant. The team was in third place. So I guess he got dinged for all those things. I don't know. What did you think about the MVPs?
Well, I gave Masataka Yoshida one of his two first place votes.
Okay.
So that's what I thought. I thought he was the MVP. I thought he was the MVP last year as well, although in retrospect, I probably would have voted for him that way, but I didn't have access to the same information I had this year. So, that's more my bias, my personal bias than anything. But I figured Yamamoto was going to win because it seems like everybody had decided, well, you know, they buy into the thing. Well, if you lead your league in so many things, that must make you the best player.
They're lazy. They're just lazy. They just want to. They want things that they can see. And
well, I think there is a little bit. Well, we're all lazy to some one degree or another. I mean, we all.
Sure.
Part of it is, yeah, don't vote for somebody who someone's going to laugh at. With the exception of, we're still trying to figure out the one guy who kept Shohei Ohtani from winning a unanimous MVP in 2016 because he voted for Naoyuki Miyanishi.
I was not that guy.
No, we're not me neither. But people do like the thing in Japan is to more or less a desire or a need to go with the crowd is very strong. And that if you don't go with the crowd, you've got to explain yourself. Whereas you can make the stupidest decision in the world, but if it's everybody goes with it, it's like, oh, I'm safe. So,
yeah, right.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah. I had war people explaining to me, and I got into a fairly long Twitter diatribe with, you know, war in which it was like two people saying, not only get off my lawn, but one of them, but not agreeing on what the definition of a lawn was. You know, he's saying,
just get off my property, whatever.
Yeah, well,
he was making
assertions about the system I use, and I was making assertions, but I think he doesn't really grasp it. And I certainly don't grasp war that well. But one of the arguments in favor of Yamamoto is that, you know, in 100 and what did he pitch? 190 innings or something, and he faced 1,000 hitters or something like that. But you know, he had many more interactions with batters. But the thing is, a pitcher's interaction with batters is like 40%, probably less than 40% of that is the impact of the pitcher. The batter has a much larger impact on that than the pitcher does, and the defense also has an impact. So it's not a one-to-one thing, and war kind of values players on their scarcity. And the worst pitchers are really bad. The worst pitchers are so bad that really good pitchers get shot through the roof. And the average hitter, you know, the best regular hitters, the worst regular hitters are so much better than the worst regular pitchers. I think it inflates their value in war, and people are, you know, don't like it when I say that, but yeah, tough. It's Thursday. Go south.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I mean,
yeah, it's a scarcity thing rather than a value thing is what I'm
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, I always say that the pitcher has help. The batter really doesn't. Yeah, the batter really doesn't. So
right.
You've got to put the ball in play with your skills. But with the pitcher on the mound, he's got a catcher helping him try to defeat the batter or at least make him have weak contact somehow. And then you've got defensive players stationed all over to help you in case you make a mistake.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you know, the odds are stacked against you in the first place.
Yeah.
So,
another
I hear what you're saying.
Another thing is when you're playing, when you're only, you know, the thing about pitchers is they can blow up games, and that's where the bad pitching comes in. You're comparing this guy who's really an outlier to guys who are so terrible that if you gave them 5 innings a week, they would lose every single week because they'd leave the game and they'd be losing 10-2. You know, so those are the guys. Right. But if you, the thing is, you can't do that with a hitter because there's no hitter who's going to have an impact on a game like that. Hitters mm-hmm. don't lose games. They sort of like fail to win them. You know, they fail to pull their weight. Sometimes occasionally they'll win them, but they, you know, your cleanup hitter going 0-for-4 is not going to be the sole reason you lost the game.
Right. 0-for-4 with, you know, three double plays and a strikeout. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the three double plays, that's put that you're getting up there
but
now.
Still, but somebody else can make up for that. But
right.
You cannot
make pitcher gives up five runs in the first inning. There's not a lot of, you know, you can't, you know,
that's hard to
know.
Overcome.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. Tammy Faye Baker couldn't put enough makeup on that thing.
Whoa. A blast from the really bad past. All right. Well, let's get away from that before I have to wipe something off your face.
Indeed.
But yeah, I understand. What about the rookies? You had any comments about or any opinions about the rookie of the year?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was obvious Tai Seoto was going to win. He was the third rookie to save 30 games. Did he save 30 or close to 30, 28 or something?
I thought he saved 40.
Well, he was the third first-year player to save as many games. He tied the first-year record from Yasuaki Yamasaki and Masato and Doji Kuribayashi of the Carp. And they each won Rookie of the Year. He won Rookie of the Year. That was sort of cut and dry to... I mean, I didn't vote for him, but, you know, that was going to be sort of obvious.
Yeah, he had 37 saves.
Yoshinobu.
Yeah, it's Yoshinobu Mizukami. Yeah.
Mizukami. The Lions was kind of a little surprise, but the Pacific League was kind of a weak collection here. I had a couple people I liked better than him, but... But yeah, but they're both, you know, he had a good year and Tai Seoto definitely had a good year. So I'm not angry. You know, I'm really angry that people get voted awards because it's very rare that somebody gets something that is so obviously weird. You know, even the guys who are thinking, well, I would have voted for somebody else. I would have voted for five people more than them. But generally, they're sort of, you know, they had good seasons. They might not be the best season. They might not, you know, but, you know, I'm not too, as I'm like Senichi Hoshino told me when I asked him why he wasn't so ornery anymore when he was manager of the Rakuten Eagles. He says, that's because I'm old. Yep.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. No, I didn't. I thought Mizukami had a chance to win because he had turned a lot of heads. I knew, as you said early on, or when we even brought up the notion of rookies, that Ota was going to win it, and he did do so well. And I think, you know, that his first outing was against the Dragons, and they got some runners on somehow and put him in a pinch, and then he pitched his way out of that. And I just really think that kickstarted his strong season because that gave him a lot of confidence that his stuff would play if he just threw it over the plate or threw it where, you know, made his pitches, made him where he, if he executed the pitches the way he wanted to, that he would get out of trouble or they wouldn't make good contact. And that's what happened. And we saw him go through the season pretty much as well as any rookie we've seen at that position. So yeah, excellent work for those guys. So I didn't think there were any standout guys in the Pacific League who were going to be better than Mizukami. So, all right. So anyway, yeah. He was good. And I think he wasn't a runaway winner with it, but I didn't think other people were close. So, all right, let's move along and make a four seam transition. And now it's time for Nippon Sham. So we heard around the end of the season that the Nippon Ham Fighters new dome, Escon Field, was not NPB compliant in terms of the distance between home plate and the stands behind the backstop. And it was about 3 meters or 3 yards short of what it was supposed to be according to rules. So NPB said, well, the fighters can play in the park this season, but it must renovate. The fighters have to renovate the stadium next year in time for the 2024 season. So my takeaway was twofold. The rules aren't really rules if they can play. And the fighters playing half of their games there have a distinct advantage on wild pitches when it comes to the rest of the league because they play so many games there. Now, other teams come in and those teams definitely have the same field to play on. However, they're different teams. They're not the same team playing there all the time. So it's you have that situation and then it's gone. So I think the team that has 70 games there probably has a distinct advantage with that. So it might not be huge on the scoreboard. We might see guys move over and not score. We might see guys move up from second to third and still not score. Or we might see guys get to third and not score. But I don't know. I don't think this is, you know, I was concerned that they were going to have to either do some reconstruction. And I thought, well, there's no way they're going to move the infield. They can't do that. So the only thing they can do is take some of those seats out behind the plate. Well, that's going to cost money. And they probably sold all of those seats to season ticket holders. So that's going to be even more difficult. So I thought, well, the easiest thing to do then it would be to scrape up whatever turf they have there, push the outfield or push everything toward the outfield. They could do that. In my mind, I'm no engineer, so I'm just thinking, hey, you know, we can get a couple of backhoes in there and have this thing done in a month. But apparently not. So what was your takeaway, first of all?
Well, I think your algebra is correct. I would think that knowing the fighters and the purpose of the stadium is basically for them to generate cash by all means necessary. So the chances that they're going to say, well, let's take these $150 a game seats or $200 a game seats and take those out instead of removing 60, you know, seven, you know, $10 a game seats.
The cheap seats, you can say.
Yep, the cheap seats, as they are. Well, they're cheap now. We don't know when the fighters get through with them what they'll be. They'll be high value items in there. Maybe you'll get an extra sausage or something when you go to the park.
There'll be NFTs by the time I get rid of them.
Probably, yeah. So non-fightable tokens, I suppose. So anyway, yeah, so that the whole thing was really interesting, and it got a great twist on Monday, and I credit the Nikon Sports for this, because the NPB executive committee discovered this, I guess, at the end of November or early December, and they said to the fighters, okay, well, this is it. This is the rule, and you didn't do it, so we're going to ding you. And amateur baseball said, okay, now what you have to understand is that Japan's NPB's rules are not decided by NPB alone, unlike MLB, which basically makes rules and then has to have the players sign off on them to some degree. NPB's rules don't require any input from the players.
Okay.
But they do require input from amateur baseball, because that's the way it's been done since 1958. And what they do basically is try to faithfully reproduce MLB's rules, translating them and adjusting them as needed for Japan. And amateurs and pros sit on the same rules committee, and it met on Tuesday. And on Monday, the Nikon Sports reported that amateur baseball said, we've got the best solution for Japanese baseball, and it's this. The MLB rules don't say the backstop must be 60 feet from home plate. MLB, which is what Japanese rules say. And the rule that they decided on in 1958 was, when all possible, we will adhere to the essential spirit of MLB rules. That is our fundamental guiding principle. And so the amateurs said, well, if we're going to adhere to MLB's rules, we should change it to what MLB actually says instead of how it was translated back in the 50s, which is the recommended distance from home plate to the backstop is 60 feet. Not required, and that a large number of MLB parks are not 60 feet.
Mr. Loophole to the county, to the courtesy.
Exactly. So the amateurs said, we have the perfect solution that's going to be for the greater benefit of the game. And you know what NPB said?
Thank you.
Get out of here, kid. You bother me. Because as I wrote about it in my newsletter on Sunday, if you've lived in Japan long enough, you know that this whole thing about Japanese quality control is basically because Japan trains children from an early age to spy on their colleagues and catch them out making mistakes. And when you do, because every peer group is hierarchical, every peer group is not democratic, but hierarchical in Japan. And whoever's on the top gets to decide where the benefits of the group are assigned. And people who make mistakes get shoved down and are replaced by people who don't make mistakes. So 11 NPB owners said, we've got a chance to punish the fighters and move up in the pecking order, or we can do what's best for the good of the game. Well, they said, like, good of the game. Yeah, what lunatic asylum did you come out of? This is Japan, buddy.
Fingers up and let's start pointing.
Yeah, exactly. So they said, oh, well, we'll think about it. But I guarantee you 100% that if this had happened a year ago, if the amateurs had said, oh, the rules are wrong, NPB would have said, good, let's fix it. But as soon as the fighters stuck their foot in it, they said, no way.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to somebody at the office and I talked to them about this whole thing as soon as we saw this story. I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast. I don't think we have. No. And I said, you know, Shinjo played at this stadium. You know, we played with the fighters and probably suffered a lot because it has so much foul ground. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he mentioned something to the powers that be in the fighters' upper brass or front office and said, hey, man, can you guys make sure there's as little foul territory as possible? This place, Fukuoka, Chiba, what is it? Zozo Marine Stadium. These places have just way too much foul territory. Let's tighten that up a little bit. I'm sure he made some kind of, I told my colleague, I'm sure he made some kind of comment. Well, come to find out that I don't know if it was true or not, but there was a report that Shinjo had helped this situation along in terms of cutting down on the foul territory, and that's part of why it was so minimal. So who knows if it's actually true? I did not read the report myself. This was a colleague who said he found something out about it. But this is a mess. I mean, again, my first takeaway, you know, if rules are not rules, then I see why you wouldn't enforce it. Otherwise, make them, they have plenty of time once this was discovered, make them compliant. You know, it's just a matter of drawing the infield and digging out some more infield here. I mean, are we talking real grass here or artificial turf? If it's artificial turf, lay that sucker down again. I mean, it's not impossible.
Yeah, they could like Cebu did the year they took that Matsuzaka money and refurbished the turf at that.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, and they, as the former batting coach for the Oryx Buffalo said on opening day, it looks like they hired a bunch of middle school kids to come out in the middle of the night and put down carpet squares.
Well, this is like I said, this is a Nippon sham. I don't really know how the MPB, and so essentially they said it was recommended, but that they want them to be compliant by 2024? Or, I mean, do we get to 2024 and the fighters say, hey, look, we played a whole season this way. Why are you going to make us change now?
Yeah, a rule, as you, I think you're right. A rule is not a rule unless you enforce it. Well, you know, which gets us to like the collision rule, which is only enforced when somebody begs them to enforce it. Or it's not enforced at all. I mean, it's just like people go, yeah, like, yeah, who cares?
Or, yeah, it's just completely obvious and unfair. But, yeah, yeah, as long as it's a rule, as long as you do it very slyly and, you know, it's not obvious, it's not easy to tell. All right, let's move along. Let's make one of those seamless transitions and talk about another rule. The Ohtani rule, the Shohei Ohtani rule. Now, you have to introduce this one because I actually did not see it.
Yeah, this came in the same rule committee meeting, and this is a case of, well, if it's a rule before the fact, we're good with it being accurate. of course, it's not just MLB. It was an MLB rule, but it was quickly adopted by the World Baseball and Softball Confederation, so it's going to be a rule in all world tournaments. So the Ohtani is making worldwide waves, and the rule is the one that was introduced for the first time at the 2021 All-Star Game, when Shohei Ohtani started for the American League and batted first as the DH.
Started on the mound and batted as DH.
Yeah, it was an exception there. It was an exemption to the normal rules because everybody wanted to see it. Well, they said, well, geez, let's do it, you know, all the time. And so this is, as I put it, this was the Christmas present for the Nippon Ham Fighters. They got the lump of coal in their stocking from the same rules committee. But getting the Ohtani rule is going to be a big help because their first round draft choice was a pitcher outfielder Kota Yazawa.
Oh, that's right, Yazawa.
From Nippon Sports Science University. So he's their guy, and he's the next two-way player on the radar in Japan.
And I guess this might help Junya Nishi of Hanshin, but he has to get an opportunity to do it in Interleague, I suppose.
Right, right. Yeah. Until the Giants get their way. And, of course, the Giants made a big deal about having a universal DH, but that was only when they were losing in the Japan Series. It's not as big a deal when somebody else is losing in the Japan Series.
Losers. Yeah, they're not too worried about it. So this is going to start next year for the upcoming season for 23. So, I mean, again, probably not a big deal.
No.
The fact that it is starting this year is good. And that I hope it leads to more players having the opportunity. That's all I'm looking for. Because when we talked about Shohei Ohtani going over to the States, that's all I ever talked about was just giving the opportunity. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that he would be changing rules worldwide and that he would be such an icon after two basically MVP caliber seasons in back to back seasons here in the major leagues. So it's so awesome. But if more, obviously when he came out, he had a lot of leverage. He was going to leave and go to the States, and the fighters talked him into staying and starting his career here. There's some other players out there who have some leverage because you need more than ability. Unfortunately, you need some proof, you need a resume, and you have to build that somehow. And so if some players who have a resume and can build that up, get the opportunity, I would love to see it. So I don't think the rule is going to really have a big impact right away. Maybe we'll see some down the line here.
No, I think I think it's kind of like the WBC. Somebody made a really good comment about the WBC, which we'll be speaking about in a moment, which is when you look at the players now who are committing early to the WBC, it's a vast difference from the way it used to be. And Mike Trout said, look, I was watching the WBC. And now this is going to date me too. I mean, he said, I was watching it when I was in junior high school. I'm going,
Smack you to Mike.
I know. It's like, exactly. Get out of my timeline, you know. Go back to the past or something. Get out of here. And we've grown up with it. And it's reminiscent of how Japanese kids now think about MLB as a future, when 10 years ago they really didn't. I'm saying, you know, you were in junior high school and high school when Nomo was playing. Yeah, but it's really the kids who grew up because MLB was on TV every morning when they were in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on, you know, on the weekends, and they could watch it, and they were going, wow, this is cool. It's different. And so they had that. It was that the group 10 years later. So now we're seeing the same kind of effect of all the kids. Masataka Yoshida saying, geez, when I was a kid, I was watching MLB, and I thought if that was something I might want to do. This is something guys like Norichika Aoki and Akinori Uemura, who you mentioned earlier, really didn't have. You know, they didn't get that MLB thing until they were already in high school and college. But
right.
So it's taking hold like that, and so we're seeing the U.S. team and the way the competition works, it's going to be very likely that if Japan can win one game, it's a quarterfinal at Tokyo Dome. Then it'll likely end up in a confrontation with either the Dominican Republic or the U.S. in Miami. So that's going to be like really fun.
Well, let's continue the conversation and talk about the Samurai Japan team. So I didn't see the warm-up games that they played, but they performed fairly well. I actually did see the games. I watched them on TV. I didn't see them live. Mm. And they performed very well. And I know that some players from the States, including Yu Darvish and Ohtani, want to play. And you look at the fact that the Japanese team is going to be stacked anyway with the MPB All-Stars it already has. I just think Japan looks really good. But keep in mind, the MLB has a plethora of all major league players to choose, a big pool from which to choose. They're still going to be strong. I just don't know. And a lot of guys want to play. We heard Adam Jones talk about that before. A lot of the U.S. players want to play. So it should really be competitive this next time.
Right. Yeah, that was a thing when it first started that a lot of people didn't know what, you know, what is it, and is it going to, how is it going to affect my career? And we had things like Dontrell Willis basically ending his career in the WBC. And it was not really happy. It was sort of a mismatch for many people's conceptions of what baseball is. Mm-hmm. And it's still not the ideal time to run it, but, you know, that's going to change eventually when it becomes such a big thing that it has to happen in the summer. Mm-hmm. But you know, until then, it's a big thing. It's getting to be a bigger thing. Japan's going to be the thing I would say about Japan is it took 8 years of really mediocre. I mean, Japan reached the semifinals with two kind of mediocre teams.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mediocre teams because after winning the first two WBCs, Japan said, well, we can't keep depending on an active manager, because they wanted Koji Akiyama to manage the 2013 team.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, you can't take me away from the team. It's not fair to the team. And it was, and Sadaharu had to do it in 2006 because he was a big part of the reason why the WBC actually existed. He couldn't turn around and say no. And Yomiuri was a big sponsor of the 2009 WBC, so Tatsunori Hara couldn't say no.
Right.
So they ran out of managers who couldn't say no. And so they picked a guy who was basically never a good manager to begin with, Koji Yamamoto, whose entire success as a manager came to him having a really good head coach who didn't like to be in the forefront.
Okay.
When he was with the Hiroshima Carp, he was basically messed up a bunch of teams that were really, really strong. He wasn't a good manager. He's a wonderful guy. I love him. He's a nice guy. He's just not the greatest man. Was not really very talented or top-notch manager. And they picked him because nobody else wanted the job. Okay, and they got to the semifinals and lost, but they didn't get the best players available. Mm-hmm. A lot of the players backed off of that tournament. They didn't get Yu Darvish. He didn't want any. A lot of the MLB guys didn't want anything to do with it. 2017 comes and they've got Hiroki Kokubo, who's basically who had never coached, never managed, and managed like he had never coached or managed. And nobody wanted anything to do with it. And again, they reached the semifinals. Now they bring in Hideki Kuriyama, who I'm convinced, I think it's fairly obvious, 100% the reason why Hideki Kuriyama was chosen was because he was Ohtani's manager with the Nippon Ham Fighters.
You're right.
Okay. But he's a well-respected manager. Of course, before him, they had Atsunori Inaba, who was a well-respected coach. You know, he had coached, and when he managed the Japan team, he managed like he knew what he was doing. And I'm sure that if the WBC had been held before, that guys would have signed up for it if it had been held on schedule in 2021. Right. But they hired Kuriyama, and he's, you know, he knows what he's doing. He's the greatest manager in the world, but he's a good manager with a positive track record. And he's a cerebral guy who communicates well with people. And look what happened. Everybody and their cousin wants to be on the WBC team. So Japan's going to have basically everybody to choose from. There's not going to be any of this. Kodai Senga, who would like to play if he can figure a way around spring training. Seiya Suzuki has said he is committed to playing now, even though he really wanted to stay with the Cubs for a full spring training because last year was a short one. He's never mm-hmm. had a full MLB spring training. So all the guys, Yu Darvish, who pitched late into the offseason, he kind of would like to have a normal offseason, you know, and he pitched late into the postseason. His agent said he would like to have like a regular offseason, but they're all going to, you know, do what they wanted to do. Ohtani was kind of easy because he wanted to play in 2017 and he couldn't because of an ankle injury. So he was sort of the one I figured would go in. But it's going to be Japan's team is going to be nasty, nasty, nasty. But they could lose the one quarterfinal game because they only have one shot. It's not a league quarterfinal like it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be watching intently with everybody else. I was thinking I wanted to go and try to cover some of the games, but I don't think it's going to be possible.
I think I am. I am going to get to cover them.
I'm a good guy.
Yep, I think I am, and I think I can. I'm the little old sports writer who thinks he can.
Okay. Good luck.
Little old man.
All right. One note before we go, because I do want to wrap it up here. Japan's version of the Rule 5 draft did take place recently, and the Giants picked up Rui Okoye from the Rakuten Eagles, and he's still only 25. I've always liked his speed and his defensive ability. He just really hasn't been able to make enough contact to be relevant at the plate, but he could be that guy who comes in and maybe steals a base for you. He can certainly play defense for the Giants and contribute on the top team a little bit. I just don't know that he is ever really going to hit with all that physical ability he has, but interesting pickup by the Giants there.
My guy in the draft was the guy they invented the draft for. Mm-hmm. Now the draft was brought up by the players union, and I wasn't surprised that the owners went with it. Because for a variety of reasons, but basically the original concept on the player side was to give these fringe guys who had, you know, let's say you've got a good minor league guy who can only get into 15 games when the first baseman, you know, when the first team guy's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he rips in the minor leagues, but he's just never going to get, he's got no chance to play. And a couple of those guys found jobs. And one, and the guy who I liked the best went to the Chinichi Dragon, Seiya Hosokawa. This guy is a minor league. He's really, really shown.
Outfielder, right?
Yep. And he's a guy who has raked. He absolutely can play. He needs basically playing time to make the adjustments. But as I've said before, the number of guys who've succeeded beyond a certain level in the minors, who have been given 400 plate appearances in a season in NPB, mm-hmm. have a track record that is close to 100%. They're pretty much regulars or above. So I think this is a guy who can really help the Chunichi Dragons, who ironically they're the guy they, I thought it was interesting. As I said, every team had to put up two players in the draft and they had to take one. So there was no sitting out of it. I'm curious to see what happens if teams were allowed to not put up anybody or to not take anybody. My guess is nobody would have moved.
Right.
But everybody, I mean, everybody was required to take one player. And you know how many players moved in the draft? Well, 12, exactly. The bare minimum. Surprise. Yeah. So that's yeah. So I'm looking forward to see how you know, Chiaki Tone is an interesting guy who used to have a career with the Yomiuri Giants. He went to the Hiroshima Carp and oh, there's the a couple of,
yes.
Yeah, there's a couple of guys who actually had some value who moved. So, that was a pleasant surprise because my guess with NPB is, yeah, no, nobody of any value is going to go because teams don't want to let anybody go.
Right, right. We don't want to look stupid by letting a
That's guy with right. It's not about work. It's not about losing talent. It's about looking stupid in front of the fans, which most of the teams are already more than capable of doing without a draft.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right, everyone. Have a very Merry Christmas, a very Happy New Year. We will talk to you when we open up year 13. And I'll keep you guys posted on Twitter as to when that will be. And hopefully we'll get our panel discussion going and have that show. And then, geez, we got 1 month, the month of January, and then February 1st, camps open. Yep. They call it spring. Anyway.
They do it to mess with you.
They're not messing with me, and they're not tricking me either because it's freezing. Anyway, just to let you guys know what I've been doing here in the off season, besides catching up on sleep and watching Columbo episodes from the 80s show, I have a story coming out on Yuta Watanabe, the player with the Brooklyn Nets, and that'll be in the paper on Monday and online probably sometime this weekend. And I'm trying to work on a story about a player who is half Australian, half Japanese, born in Japan. He did make his NHL debut last season and has scored a goal, and hopefully he'll be playing more. So I'm trying to arrange that interview and get that done. And then I know Jim is keeping jballallen.com up and running.
Yeah.
And you sent
a little
out,
bit, little bit, little bit.
Yeah,
I'm doing weekly. I'm doing more weekly stuff than daily stuff, but that will change.
Good. All right. So we will talk to you next year. Enjoy your off season.
See you in the springtime.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at @JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with #HighHeat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.